Hello and welcome to Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3, Sydney's local and independent current affairs. I'm Evie Maguire. Today on Razor's Edge...
Youth leisure isn't spent outside as much. It's spent through digital connection with people.
We bring you the latest episode of Seeking Sydney, where we took to the Sydney streets to answer the question sent in by Ellen. Where did all the emo kids who used to hang out at Town Hall steps go? Also coming up on Razor's Edge.
The people that are the closest to you are the people you can't tell because they just don't get it.
We look into the cultural challenges faced by those who struggle with anxiety. All that and more coming up on Razor's Edge. But first, 1 month ago, four rare animal skeletons were nabbed from the University of Sydney's Haswell Teaching Museum. Despite the best efforts of police, the thieves are yet to be caught. In the latest episode of Seeking Sydney, Max Tillman spoke to an academic, an auctioneer, a police officer and a private investigator to find out where the missing bones could be.
Have you ever thought about how you'd pull off a museum heist? Would you sneak in under the cover of darkness? Would you escape by high-powered speedboat? Or would you just walk in and out of the building as if nothing ever happened? It's not a question that Sydneysiders often consider, but sometime between the 9th of the 7th and early hours of the 8th of November, four rare animal skeletons, including a full hippopotamus skull dating back more than a century, were stolen from the University of Sydney's Haswell Teaching Museum. A month on, and the culprits have yet to be caught, which begs the question, where are the thieves? And more importantly, where are the bones? Acting Crime Manager from Inner West Police Command, Detective Acting Inspector Mark George, has been assigned to the case.
Between 11 a.m. on Wednesday the 7th of November and 9:30 a.m. on Thursday the 8th of November, a full hippopotamus skull, a hawksbill sea turtle skeleton with shell, a walrus skeleton and a full dog skeleton were stolen from the museum in Camperdown that was established at the campus in 1890.
But even for an experienced senior officer like Detective George, the theft of rare and exotic animal bones from Australia's oldest university campus is an unusual assignment.
It is unusual. As I said, the skeletons appear to date back to 1880, so they're quite old and they hold special value to the university. So we have detectives and other investigators looking into this case in the hope that we can recover the skeletons.
Dr. Jude Philp is the curator of the Maclean Museum at the University of Sydney. The museum staff and a team of dedicated students have been painstakingly cataloguing the Haswell collection as part of a program to digitise its contents for students and the public.
We're a mixture of natural history, so mammals and fish and their insides, their outsides, their bits in jars and so on, as well as collections from across Pacific and Aboriginal Australia.
But those dating to the turn of the 19th century are invaluable to the university's reputation as a hub for international research.
We opened to the public in 1892, but the oldest parts of our collection are an insect collection that Alexander Macleay, colonial governor in the 1820s, brought with him from England. So some of our collection items are sort of in the 1760s, 1770s range.
The items involved in the theft, a hippopotamus skull, a hawksbill sea turtle skeleton complete with a shell, a slow loris skeleton and a full dog skeleton were not on public display, but used exclusively for teaching purposes. According to Dr. Philp, they provided invaluable hands-on experience for aspiring natural scientists.
Across the university are a number of things that are used for teaching and... Because the university has been established since 1855, some of those teaching collections have very old material in it, which is why these things involved in the theft were of the 1880s, 1890s.
According to the police, the audacious heist occurred sometime between 11 a.m. on November 7th and 9:30 a.m. on November 8th. But it does appear the assailants made a quick getaway with campus security and a network of CCTV cameras on their tail, leaving behind three more skeletons in what was a quick and frantic escape. Detective Acting Inspector George again.
They appear to have been left behind after the offenders have broken into the museum, along with some other items that are being forensically examined by specialist police. We're also looking into some closed-circuit television footage.
But what to do with a hippopotamus skull? You can by no means take it to your local cash converters. And despite pawnbroker's reputation for an ask-no-questions attitude to whatever crosses the shop front door, Inspector George is confident that should any items surface within one of Sydney's pawnbrokers, police would be immediately informed.
Yeah, they're not your everyday items like a television or a DVD player, which we would ordinarily hope that pawnbrokers can identify at their shops and assist police with that kind of information.
David King is one of Sydney's most prominent private investigators. He's seen everything from spousal disputes to stolen fine art in a career spanning over two decades.
Well, you'd always examine the scene first. You've got to establish things like, was it a true break and enter? Was it staged? Are there any signs of false entry? You've got to things like, is there security footage? Is there swipe card access to the areas? Things like that are all the first things that come into it. And that's normally done on scene.
David agrees with the police force in that items as unique and recognisable as those stolen from the collection would be practically impossible to offload to a pawnbroker. In his opinion, if the burglars have any intention of selling the skeletal remains, a buyer would have been set up long in advance and meticulously planned.
The market here for something like this is next to zero. We'd be contacting ourselves as part of the investigation. We'd be contacting an industry expert to find out who would be the likely people to receive this. And, you know, you're talking possibly collectors, but, you know, that's probably the limit of it, isn't it? So normally you would already have a sale lined up in a circumstance like this. It's not really the sort of thing where you've just on a whim stolen it and then try to sell it on eBay.
For David, all signs point to the stolen skeletons potentially falling victim to a practical joke. The skeletal remains have already been shown to be practically unsellable in Australia, leading David to believe an operation involving underground antique dealers, black-clad thieves, and motion-sensing lasers is far less likely than a botched prank by students with lasting consequences.
That would be very high on my list of suspects, that's for sure. Student would come into it because something like this has got a very limited use outside of the university. So it's more likely to be yahooing as opposed to a true crime.
But where's the fun in that? Whilst an underground network of antique dealers ferrying stolen animal skeletons through the dingy alleys and secret tunnels seems ridiculous, it's still a thought worth entertaining. John Albrecht is the managing director of Leonard Joel Auctioneers, one of the country's most prominent auction houses. In his experience, whilst pawnbrokers are heavily regulated, antique dealers and auctioneers enjoy an enormous amount of freedom in their industry.
You know, that is an exceptionally good question. The fact that the actual pawnbroking industry is an ancient one and a reasonably simple one and was maybe an easier one to regulate, I don't know. Obviously, the antiques and auction market is not a highly regulated market. That's not uncommon even globally.
This lack of regulation adds a further element of intrigue to the case, and Inspector George and his team of investigators are not ruling anything out, regardless of how far-fetched it may seem, in their pursuit of the Haswell Collection's uninvited skeletal enthusiasts.
Certainly, obviously, around the world, there's antiques dealers and those types of thefts occurring. We're unsure as to the motive of why these items were stolen in this instance, but we are taking this theft very seriously. We have a number of investigators looking at various avenues to try and recover these stolen items.
But what if there's more to this? While 2SER is in no way implying that staff or students from the University of Sydney are responsible for the theft, David King's 25-year career in private investigating has given him a rare perspective on cases such as this.
Not skeletons, that's for sure. We've had an issue with an art gallery and it was not dissimilar, really, at the end of the day. Turned out in that situation it was a staff member that was involved and we were able to ascertain that as part of our investigation. But I can't say we've had anything relating to something as left-field as skeletons.
Such instances of museum artefacts being nabbed by staff is not without precedent in Australia, with one of the most well-known cases being a former Australian Museum pest controller whose obsessive collection of fauna specimens led to the theft of more than 2,000 skulls, skins and skeletons between 1998 and 2003, according to records made available by the New South Wales District Court. Judge Peter Berman SC, who presided over the case in 2007, found the offender's thefts to have caused an enormous amount of harm to the museum's reputation.
It's quite you know, the percentage of these things, inside jobs are quite high, particularly with more unusual items. You know, as you say, a hippopotamus skull, it's no easy move. But, you know, I have to admit, I've been to a similar thing, like to a university outside of regular hours, and all the rooms are open, and you can wander around in there as much as you like, and there's nobody there. So it's not inconceivable that it was just a spur-of-the-moment thing by some young idiots. It's just where I'm still leaning towards myself personally.
If you or anyone you know has a confirmed sighting of a hippopotamus skull, the skeleton of a hawksbill sea turtle, including its shell, the skeleton of a slow loris or that of a full dog, don't hesitate to contact Crime Stoppers on 1-800-333-000.
Max Toolman ending that report. If you have any Seeking Sydney questions you want us to answer, please head on over to the website 2scr.com/seekingsydney.
He's one of the most influential songwriters of his generation, John Prine. Frontier Touring and Love Police present the Tree of Forgiveness Tour on Saturday, March 9 at the State Theatre. Pick up his latest album, The Tree of Forgiveness, out now. Don't miss John Prine with special guest Tyler Childers live on Saturday, March 9 at the State Theatre. Tickets on sale now through Ticketmaster. Visit frontiertouring.com for more info. 2SER sponsors.
I'm Evie Maguire and you are listening to Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3. For those living with anxiety, the challenges of everyday life can be quite difficult. And for those facing them within an Indian culture, maintaining a perfect family life, or even the illusion of one, can be exhausting. Julia Carr-Katzel has the story. Just a warning, this story contains themes of mental health. If it triggers anything alarming, please call Lifeline on 13 11 14.
In our culture, we do not ever talk about mental health. You then have to keep it to yourself.
This is Monica. She's a local in Sydney who struggles with anxiety. After talking to Monica, which isn't her real name, I understood that her experience with anxiety was exacerbated by layers upon layers of cultural expectation, leaving Monica, like many, to suffer in silence.
I've been married now for about 9.5 years, and I live in a very, very extended family. But I think that comes with the Indian culturally background. Always trying to keep up with, you know, the reputation of the family, trying to please everyone, and you feel like it's never good enough.
Monica brought up the idea of perfection multiple times in our conversation. I followed up on what seemed to be a main stressor for her with Dr. Manjula O'Connor, psychiatrist from the University of Melbourne, who revealed a darker reality behind the notion.
For us, in our Indian culture, we believe that everyone has to be perfect. It puts an enormous pressure on the women to pretend that they don't have any problem. And they have to be perfect daughter-in-law, perfect wife, perfect mother, perfect housekeeper, perfect worker, perfect bringing in income at the same time, a sociable, beautiful woman who is also docile. And often when you are suffering from anxiety, depression, you know, all of those factors are impaired. We don't like people, particularly with mental illness, because of the stigma that it could be genetically inherited and the children might suffer.
Manjula has campaigned tirelessly for years with the aim of educating awareness of mental illness in Australia's Indian community. She says misconceptions relating to passing on genes are blown out of proportion or are simply incorrect.
It is not necessarily genetic. But there is a genetic component, but it's a small component, so it's not likely to be passed to their children, which is what they fear. It's the environmental pressures that are much more important to look at.
Maintaining the illusion of perfection is just one barrier to speaking out, but once women muster up courage to communicate their symptoms, they are often faced with a severe lack of mental literacy in the Indian community, which only further inhibits potential for treatment and recovery.
People don't even recognize it as a mental illness. The language itself is not conducive because there aren't that many words that just help describe feelings of depression, anxiety, guilt. Discomfort is expressed more in terms of relationships. For example, my patients will not say to me that I feel sad and I feel tearful. They would say something like, my mother-in-law is torturing me and my husband's criticizing me and it's so terrible and, you know, I can't stop thinking about it. But they are not able to connect that with feeling sadness. And so it stops people from getting help. There is a shame of asking for help.
Monica explained how she struggled to communicate her anxiety to her family once she found the courage to speak out.
The people that are the closest to you are the people you can't tell because they just don't get it, because it's kind of like, it's not big. It isn't big situations. You know, you're living in a big family. You're trying to please everyone. Something small happens. Oh, turn the other cheek. But how many times can you turn the other cheek before you lose the plot? Then you shut off.
In India, the suicide death rate observed in women is 3 times higher than the rate globally, with married women accounting for the highest proportion of deaths, according to a study by the Lancet Public Health Journal. Regarded by many as a public health crisis, India's disproportionately high suicide rates demand attention. Most specifically, those among women who find themselves in arranged marriages where they are less protected against suicide. In Australia, some Indian women suffer in the same way, pressured to maintain the perfect family and are sometimes trapped without the option to divorce. But Manjula says education is the basis for change when it comes to awareness of anxiety.
We have all the laws for mental health we need. It's the education now that needs to happen from ground up. It has to be the NGOs, the local community organisations who have to do this job, to educate in the sense of using cultural expressions of emotional pain that make sense to people so they can identify that, yes, this does mean that I may be depressed and that it is treatable illness.
Although there is a long way to go culturally with mental health literacy and communication, Manjula says that on an individual level, women suffering from anxiety can act immediately by seeking help from a local GP.
Immediately, the individual person can take control over their life. I mean, in Australia, we are so lucky. We have Medicare and we have access to GPs. So it's easy for people to go to their GP and go alone. Do not take your family member with you so that you can actually have an open, candid conversation with your GP and tell them what you're feeling, because your GP is the best person to help you with this, and they are non-judgmental, they are trained in mental health, they will refer you to the right person. The good news is that all of those things are treatable. I do think that individuals should start take responsibility for themselves, and then the dialogue within the home will happen.
I caught up with Monica about 8 months after she had initially shared her experience with anxiety. During that time, she'd been regularly seeing a psychologist, so I thought I'd play back the original recordings of her describing her anxiety as a kind of reflective comparison tool.
What are you thinking after listening to those?
Yeah, it's actually brought up a lot of emotions because it brings it back, because like, oh my God, yeah, I felt like that. I kind of think, God, it took me that long to realise, you know, and yeah, nearly 2 years to say, yeah, I need help. But it took me 8 months to get better. If we keep it inside, it's actually worse for us. It'll make it worse. It'll just, everything just gets bigger. Everything seems worse than it is. I'm the first one to say now, if someone says, oh yeah, you know, I'm just feeling a bit down, I'm the first one to stop and say everything okay. Because sometimes it's a little sentence like that is someone asking for help. But, you know, in our culture, it's like, oh, yeah, yeah, carry on, go in the kitchen, make some food. You know, you'll feel better, you know. But really, you're not going to feel better until you really kind of talk to someone and not feel judged. I just feel like I have a lot more control now, and I'm listening to her, and she feels like she's so lost.
And you say she because you feel detached. You don't feel like you're that person anymore.
No, thank God. I can actually say no.
we could never leave. And one way we first breathe, a place in between humanity.
Flight mode and lean back, staring at the sky with my eyes closed, thinking about the world blues I just read on BBC World News while inhaling the ciggies that I smoke. Quicker than the death toll rises in Syria due to IS, the local government and sky drones sent in to protect instead. There's 200,000 dead like the casualties, brother, my mind's blown. Seeing as the biggest issue fucking with my world, it's like a temptations I can buy for my girl. No Jimmy True for her, cause the bank's dry sense of humor, this funny money's making my smile curl. But with the bird's eye vision, I can see there's a bigger picture. I know we are just midgets surrounded by drop picks. We're tiny in the scheme, but move as a team, we'll get through this Cat Stevens wild world. You know what I'm saying?
It's a world, world. City stage on the life we lead. Make as far as against you and me. As we live, we love, we play, we be. All roads lead to that place. That sound, that smell, you know that place we'd be searching for. The one we could never leave, the one where we first breathe. That place in between humanity.